Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. They say that, the Vedas might be among the oldest living traditions. I have one for you that's even older, and that would be shamanism. And how far back it goes, who only knows, but back to the far distant reaches of human history. And it's a living tradition today. In fact, the word shaman came from the Siberian shamans. And we have with us today Jan Van Yisselstein. She has been looking into Siberian shaman for many, many years. And she's founded a school, the Amba School of Siberian Shamanism. It's here in Seattle, Washington. She's also a translator of the Olchi language. And as its assistant director and co-founder, she's been helping to bring the wisdom of this very old living tradition to the West. And it's a pleasure to have you here today, Jan. Thanks.
Thank you so very much.
So, I have to ask you about the term shaman and who the Olchi people, who you're working with very closely and bringing teachers here on a regular basis, what the history of the Olchi people is in the whole nexus of Siberian shamanism and where this term comes in.
Well, the term shaman actually comes, it's a Manchu Tungus word, and it comes from the word sama. And when the early Russian ethnographers began to explore the eastern part of Russia, they came into contact with these people. They discovered that the holy men and women were called Sama, and they mistranslated it as shamans, and it became a term that is currently used by ethnologists and anthropologists throughout the world.
What is a Sama?
It means to know, a person that knows, and that's the
adequate
translation. Just a person that knows.
How did you get interested in shamanism in general and Siberian shamanism in particular?
Back during the period of perestroika or glasnost, I met a Russian gentleman who came to the United States, and he was on a sister city tour with Portland, Oregon. He's a musician, and I met him through some friends of mine, and he had studied and worked with the Siberian people for many, many years. He was actually up in the Amur River region recording all of their traditional songs. Because they are a culture that has no written language, he was up there actually writing down all the lyrics in musical notation so that the music could be preserved. I talked to him, and he told me about the people that he worked with. And I asked him when he returned to Russia whether he would be willing to ask these people if they would wish to come to the United States to speak and to talk about their culture, because the political situations had changed. And now that the former Soviet Union had become the Russian Republic or Russian Federation, I knew it would be easier to get these people over here. So he went back and made the contacts, and I got in contact with them, and that's how it started, and that was back in 1994.
So I've met Nadja. I took one of the workshops that you offered. It was fascinating, I have to say. And tell me a little bit about establishing contact and how the school developed from that.
The first event that we had in the United States, we brought over two different cultures from the Amur River region. We brought the Olchi tradition and the Nanai people. And they come from the same language group. They live right next to each other. And so I met Nyajezda from that first visit.
She loves to say Nadia because it's much easier.
It's much easier. It's like remembering Nadia Comaneci in the Olympics. Yes, it's much easier than pronouncing Nadezhda. So Nadia.
Don't even try to spell it either.
So Nadia came over, and I met her, and I met the Nanai people. But having listened to both of these cultures speak, I personally fell in love with the Ulchi tradition.
Because?
Their tradition believes that animals, rivers, rocks, streams, mountains, everything's on top and humans are on the bottom.
Oh.
And that the world is not ours.
Mm.
We're only visitors.
I like that.
And so we're here to learn to be good guests. And there was no way I could communicate with her. At that time, we were using Russian translators. So everything was coming via Ulchi to Russian and Russian into English. And so I sat and quietly listened for the first visit to her talking about her culture and her people and the way they approached life.
So you felt the only way to really hear this directly was to learn the language. How do you go about learning a language that's not even written down?
Well, there is one English speaker in their culture. Now, they're a culture of only 3,200 people, but there is an English speaker. And I asked this speaker, who happened to be Nadia's cousin, if she would be willing to teach Ulchi to me. So for a number of years, she put together audio cassettes. Since the language is not written, it's only an oral language, she put a series of cassettes together.
What was on the cassettes? How would she
structure it? Lots of
words.
Mm-hmm. Lots of words. And after about the first year, I said, thank you very much, but please give me grammar.
So she'd say, here's this word, sama, and it translates
sama
to
sama is shaman, yeah. Kuska, cat. Inda, dog. So it was learning lots of words in the very beginning, but having no grammar. So after a while, she began to give me grammatical structure to the language.
How different is it from English or other languages?
It's difficult in regards to cases. Now, I'm not a linguist, but Ulchi has 8 cases, and I've discovered that there are only 2 other languages on the planet that have 8 cases.
What are they?
They are Finnish and Sanskrit.
Oh, my.
But the language is pretty easy beside that. It's pretty much subject, object, verb in its construction.
So if you get a case here or there wrong, I'm sure they forgive you.
They do. They forgive me.
Yeah. So how many years did it take you to really be comfortable in this language, learning it from cassette?
About 2 or 3 years.
That's quick. You just have a head for languages, I would assume.
Either that or I really wanted to speak to these people. So probably a little bit of both.
So so setting up a school, was that exciting for Nadia as a spokesperson to have an American base now? And what's her attitude towards, or the Ulchi people's attitude towards sharing their ways of life and tradition with the West?
What I find to be interesting is that unlike Native American people in this culture, the Siberian people were never exploited for their philosophy. They were quite surprised when Americans showed interest in studying and learning about their ways in the world. So when we asked Nadezhda, Nadia, if she would be willing to have an ongoing school and whether she would be willing to come here and sometimes bring elders from the tribe to speak to people in America, she was quite open to the prospect. And, as I said, delightfully surprised.
They were never exploited. What's the village like and how do they coexist under the Russian government and what's the story there?
Except for natural resources that are now being taken from their area, I think when I look at things historically, I look at Siberia and I think, okay, now why weren't there, even before the Russians, great incursions into their area?
Too much snow in the winter.
Too much snow. I mean, who would want their land? I mean, who would want to go in and conquer and live in this area? So they were left alone for a very long period of time. Islam, Buddhism, Christianity never made it into their area. And as I said, except for oil and timber resources, people left them alone.
Lucky. Yeah. So what is the weather like there? I mean, how much snow do they have to deal with, and how do they cope with this? And
the village of Bulava along the Amur River region has the exact same latitude lines as Calgary. So they're located in southeastern Siberia. It's sometimes referred to as the Russian Far East. They have their river, even just to make it to these villages, is only accessible about 3.5 months out of the year.
Hmm.
Most of the time it's completely frozen, so the only way up there would be via a small bush plane. The snow is, 10, 15, 20 feet. At, I believe, its highest point during the December-January periods. And they have about a 2-month growing period. These people are primarily fishermen, and they still do a lot of hunting and gathering in the forest surrounding the villages. But I was just trying to think about the area and how to explain it to you.
It's fun to imagine them in the setting as well. Shamanism, such an old tradition, and who are the shamans in the society? What is their role? How is the society constructed? Are they small tribes? Do they still live a lot in the old ways? Does modern technology come into play? Do they have cell phones like we hear from so many?
Right.
Give a description if you would.
Well, unlike most anthropological writings, which are absolutely incorrect, shamans aren't necessarily people that are chosen by the community. For example, the Ulchi people and other Amur River people never lived in groups. They lived in a community, so to speak. They lived in large family groups, and they would be many, many miles away from another family group. For example, where Nijizda lived, her father, who was born in the 1870s at some point, he had two wives. Between those two wives, there were 25 children. Only 5 children survived to adulthood. Only 1 out of 4 children lived past the age of 2 or 3 due to disease, even prior to the incursion of the Russians. These family groups would have 18, 20, 22 people, different husbands and wives, and maybe a few cousins and their children. And then it would be another 20 or 30 miles before you got to the next family group.
Interesting. They are their own community.
Right. It was during the period of, it was just before the Russian Revolution when the Russians finally made it that far east. And they began rounding up people and putting them into villages.
Why? Why rearrange a society that's doing fine on its own? What was their motive?
The Russian government needed to keep track of their citizens. So they sort of rounded them up and made them live in communities for the first time. That didn't come into being until around the turn of the century. Before then, as I said, large family groups, very far from one another.
So what is Siberian shamanism in its distinct flavor as opposed to other types of shamanism?
Everybody in their culture believes that they can heal themselves.
Oh.
Everyone plays the drum. Everyone knows how to sing and heal and journey for themselves.
I love that. Self-empowerment, spirituality.
And it's only when you can't heal yourself that you actually go and seek a shaman.
Because the techniques are there for balancing and connecting.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Ulchi form of shamanism is that if you when you study shamanism throughout the world, you'll find that there are usually two distinct forms. Either people go and train with a shaman for many, many years and learn the techniques of that particular shaman, or the other school of thought is that only the spirits can teach you to be a shaman. The Ulchi fall into that category. The Ulchi form of shamanism believes that a person can get this calling when they're 2 years old or when they're 92 years old. It can happen at any particular time. But they do believe that people can heal themselves by singing and playing the drum and calling on their own protective and helping spirits to come to them.
How does the call come? What are the various ways in which one might hear the call from the spirits?
Through dreams. If there is a shaman that has been in your family lineage, it's not uncommon that a child or a grandchild will take up that calling, but it will usually begin in the very first instance through dreams. And your spirits will come and they'll bother you and they'll keep talking to you and they'll drive you crazy until you take up the call.
What does that entail, taking up the call? And is this why you're on this path too, Jim?
No, absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not. I'm not somebody that will ever shamanize for another person.
Everybody shamanizes them in this culture for themselves, but you're called a shaman, or you take on that role when you're able to do it for other people when they can't do it for themselves. So it's
yes and no. Actually, the word shaman, in the Ulchi tradition, there are many more complex views of what a shaman is. Psychics in their culture, for example, are considered shamans. People that are able to interpret dreams of other people are considered shamans.
Oh, so they have specialties.
Very.
What are some other examples?
There are shamans that just work with children's souls and protecting children's souls. There are shamans that actually lead the souls of the deceased into the next world. So it's much more complex. But they'd still believe that everyone can heal themselves.
And drumming's one of the key parts of it. How do they understand drumming and the building of a drum and all that?
You have
some beautiful drums at your workshop.
Yeah, the drumming comes in two ways. They have very ancient rhythms that have been carried down from their culture and taught from one generation to the next. The special songs that the shaman sings, those rhythms and those words that are given to the shaman are given to him or her by the spirits. So that will be the unique rhythms that a particular shaman will know.
And you brought some recordings of the songs that we'll be able to hear.
Yes, I brought a recording of Grandmother Tika Anga, who passed away a few years ago, and she was one of the most powerful shamans in the Ulchi culture of the 20th century. There's a second shaman named Yechka, and there's a third shaman by the name of Grandfather Misha Duvan. He passed away a few years ago, but he actually came to the United States and taught and worked here for a while. So I was very fortunate to meet him before he passed on.
So do we have time, Paul, to hear at least one of those excerpts before the break? Here it is. Who was that?
That was Grandmother Tika. She was singing a song for a group of anthropologists and ethnographers that had just come to visit. Since the fall of the Soviet Republic, the Siberian shamans are the new flavor in town when it comes to ethnographers and ethnomusicologists, etc. So they're all descending upon these poor people these days. And my favorite thing is when Nadezhda takes pictures of the anthropologists who are taking pictures of her people. Actually, it wasn't too long ago that we walked into a Barnes & Noble and opened a book on indigenous people, and Nadezhda's cousins were all in the book. And there they are. Oh, great. Hey, it's great. It's on sale. Let's take it home. It was a song she was singing. The anthropologists were asking her. They were on their way to another village. And they asked Grandmother Tika if she would go out there and look in the spirit world and make sure that their journey to this remote area would be fine, would be well. And so Grandmother Tika was out there looking at their road and seeing what was going to come up for them as they traveled to other villages.
Now, that was very interesting in the workshop, that what you saw in your vision, you would express through the drumming. So if you saw a bear in your vision, you would do the bear rhythm and the bear sounds. If you saw a tiger, another one of their totem animals, you would do that. Explain that.
The Siberian form of shamanism is that you sing your journey, and the journey is never the same twice. So as they're out there in these alternative states of reality, they are singing what they're seeing, what the landscape looks like, the spirits that they are encountering at that moment. And not only are they singing and telling you what they're experiencing, but the rhythm of the drum will change. So if they're climbing up a hill and it's a very hard hill to climb, the drum should express that. If they're encountering spirits of the wind, the drum will express the sound of the wind. If they're floating over water, you will hear the drum change once again to express that.
You know, at first I thought, well, that's pulling you out of the trance, is it not, to have to translate back into the intellect to move the drum or to make this kind of a sound in the drum. But I guess if you brought up doing that, it's just second nature.
It is.
It gets to be that way. What induces the trance for the Siberian shaman?
What induces the trance? They call upon their spirits to take them down the road, to take them on the journey. What I always find very interesting in most books is when they talk about shamanism, going down the road or going down the path, they never explain what the road or the path is. The Ilchis would tell you it's your life. Mm-hmm. It's from the moment that you're born until the moment that you die. And there are also alternative paths that exist around you, and those are your different past lives.
Interesting.
And so when you start on your road, you call your protective spirits and your helping spirits to join you. You never go on that journey without those spirits arriving first. And then they take you.
So it's the spirits that are inducing the altered states of consciousness and helping you enter this alternate
yes.
reality,
mm-hmm.
which is a visionary way of seeing your path, your life.
Your life and the life and roads of those around you.
So you see where they intersect, and I'm assuming you can time travel a bit so that one Shaman Tika could see ahead for the people who had requested that.
Yes, she could see ahead, and she could also go into these people's past lives. There have been times that I've seen Grandfather Misha talk to a man in his village where part of the problem with his health was due to a past life when he was a woman and he had two or three children, and he had to actually go to a different life to discover the cause of soul loss.
Oh, so you can repair the soul loss in this life or the next.
Yes.
We hear so much about soul retrieval, and do they do a form of that, and what's that about?
Well, the Ulchis believe that everyone has three souls. They have multiple souls, not just one soul. There's the soul that lives in your heart, that stays with you. There's the soul that you take to the dream world, and the dream world soul has its own life. And the third soul is like a double. It's your shadow is considered that third soul. Now, that third soul has its own life as well, and it comes and goes from time to time. And when it leaves for too long, that's when a person becomes physically or mentally or spiritually in distress.
So a shaman can go back and retrieve that soul.
Yes, that's the soul that they go after in any sort of soul retrieval type of work, is that third soul. And they bring it back to the person and place it back in their body. But of course, that soul's naturally going to travel and leave from time to time. It is its nature to do so. It is its nature to have its own life.
Boy, that's interesting. So the modern equivalent you could see in soul fracturing and how modern psychotherapy views that. It's a very similar process with a different slant on it, different understanding of it. But you can see the effects in modern...
Yes.
Yeah, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yes,
here.
I do. Yes, I do.
Yeah, interesting. We're talking with Jan van Yisselstein, and she's the co-founder of the Amba School of Siberian Shamanism. And we'll come back and hear more about Siberian Shamanism with Jan van Yisselstein. I'm Laura Lee. Let's continue our conversation with Jan van Yisselstein, director of the Amba, assistant director of the Amba School of Siberian Shamanism. And if you're looking for a book, Nadja contributed to First Fish, First People, Salmon Tales of the Pacific, North Pacific Rim. So have you ever had a soul retrieval done, since our souls are wont to go wandering?
Yes. One year when Grandfather Misha was visiting, I asked him if he would be willing to perform a soul retrieval on myself. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of information about how it is when you approach a shaman. And this will give you some more information about the culture. Not all shamans will accept your cases. You have to go to them. You almost have to beg them and plead with them. Will you take my case? They will have a long period of time where they will interview you. They will say,
what about?
They'll say, why are you coming here? What do you want from me? Now, shamans have a tendency to be skilled in certain areas. So, for example, if a person went to a shaman because they were epileptic, the shaman might say, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I don't specialize in epilepsy. But go see Grandmother Altica. She is very good at that, so a shaman may refer you to someone else. When you sit down, the shaman will spend an hour or two just talking to you. And if they choose to accept your case, then a soul retrieval will take place over a 3-month period.
Really?
And what they will do is every full moon or at a time of their choosing, usually when the moon is, they don't do it when the moon is dying, when the moon is going from full to new, but when it's growing from new to full, they will start a ceremony. It will usually begin in the evening, as soon as the sun goes down, and it will go all night until the next morning.
What happens in this ceremony?
The shaman will go into their different worlds and go and find out the cause and the reason why the soul is lost, why it's been fragmented.
Do they see visions about what happened to you, or does the soul speak to you or to them? Or
sometimes. Sometimes they'll ask you questions. Grandfather would ask, did this happen to you 3 years ago? Did you run into this person? Sometimes he will ask questions, or with my experience, he asked a few questions, but his main duty was to go out there and find that part of myself and return it to me. This ceremony will begin once. The next month it will be done again, and a third time the following month. I remember once asking Grandfather Misha about the fact that this was taking 3 months. I said, well, Grandfather, what do you do in between this period? He says, I'm always thinking about you. I'm always listening to what my spirits are saying. So there's a period of time between the actual soul retrievals where the shaman continues to do work for the client, even though he or she may not have the client around them. Every time they go to bed at night, they're dreaming about you. They're wandering in the woods during the day, just listening to their spirits talk to them about your case.
Do they do a couple of cases at a time?
They can do. They can do two or three people in an evening. And once again, it may be a month or two or three months in a row. Or they may do some work with you and say, okay, I've done enough for right now. Come back in 6 months and we'll do some more.
Was it very specific information that he had about you? Could you say, oh, yes, that must have been the instance when this part of my soul left?
He didn't give me much information.
Did you feel a big difference when the soul retrieval had finished?
Yes, it was quite interesting. He actually, there's a particular technique where the shaman will come back from the journey and bring that soul fragment with them. Not only do they place it through the top of your head, but they end up biting your head as well. So that was rather startling to have the top of my head bitten.
Okay. So did you feel different as the time went on after this? Did you feel more complete
yes.
in some way?
Yes, and the shamans will tell you, you don't ever feel an absolute immediate relief after a soul retrieval is done. It happens slowly, almost imperceptibly so. As days go on, as weeks go on, as months go on, you find yourself getting better and better and better.
The parts of our soul that leave, is this the same part or a different part of us that leaves and goes on these flights during our dreams or during a near-death experience? How does it?
I'm not sure in the near-death experience exactly how the Ulchis, which particular soul they would say goes into that other world. But I would say that the third soul, or what I call the doppelganger soul, or perhaps another term would be that astral double. That soul is the one that the shamans seek to bring back. That soul always has its own other life. It runs around, has a wonderful time. The shamans sometimes call it a hooligan. They will say, oh, your soul is being a hooligan. It's out cavorting with these other spirits out there. And it's been gone for too long. That's why you're not feeling well. So we need to go and bring it back and put it back in your body and make it stay close to home.
Okay. Because its job is to help animate you and be that connection between that world and this one.
Yes.
Interesting. What do we do to help make sure our soul stays home? Probably do
nothing.
Your life work.
No, passion. I don't think you can do that. They don't believe that way. It has its own consciousness.
Interesting.
It has nothing to do with you. I mean, even the idea of an intuitive vision, they don't believe that, for example, if a psychic shaman were to have a vision, they didn't give it to themselves. The spirits put it in their head.
That makes sense.
There is no collective unconscious. It's the world of spirits. It's not something that's being self-generated.
We're in communication with those spirits all the time.
All the time. They're talking to us all the time. Intuition would be explained as spirits talking to you.
Mm-hmm. The muse whispering in your ear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned that someone who had a ancestor who was a shaman might hear the call. Is that to say that that ancestor then becomes one of those spirits?
Yes, they divide their spirits into two categories. There are the helping spirits and the protective spirits. The protective spirits are people that have lived on this earth. They are ancestors, old shamans that come from your culture. Those spirits are always around you. Your mother, your father, your grandfather, your grandmother. Those are the family spirits. Your helping spirits are spirits of the water, spirits of the sky, spirits of a particular area of land, spirits of the rock, spirits of the animals. They're very different, distinct group.
So I've seen and heard about shamans who make a prayer and the winds calm down, or the waters, you can see ripples on the water. I've heard stories like that. Would this be a shaman in the Ulchi culture who might communicate with those spirits and see effects? Are they interested in, you know, making impact in nature like that? Or
the Ulchis don't believe they can control anything. So when a shaman would ask the winds to calm down, they wouldn't feel like they could command the winds to calm down. They would ask very nicely, "Would you please calm down?" And if the winds did calm down, even the most powerful shaman would be surprised. They're always surprised that things happen.
Are animals among those helping spirits?
Some animals are, and shamans will have animal helpers that they will be their guides on their journeys. And shamans can also teleport and transport into animals' bodies and use them to see things. When Nijishta visits here, Grandmother Indica always comes and visits. Now, this little old lady in her late 80s has never left her village, ever.
Yet she's
traveled
all over the
place. And she flies here. She flies here as a crow. I mean, she's always here, and every time she's flying around, Nadia and I will look and say, "Oh, there's Grandmother Indica spying on you again." But when Nijishta returns to her village, Indica will tell her everything that Nijishta did in detail. The house that Nijishta stayed in, the people that she met, in absolute detail.
Boy, the shamanist internet here.
Yes.
Telecommunication system.
Absolutely. They can transport themselves into animals' bodies for short periods of time.
So the way that the Siberian shamans, the Ulchi people, would view this would be that this grandmother was able to share the spirit of the crow that was right here with you and Nadia here, and see through its eyes and understand and hear your conversation and look around and see what Nadia's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then her soul would say, "Thanks for sharing your body. I'll go back now."
Absolutely.
It's not like it's displacing the crow. That would be
impolite.
No, not
at all.
That would be
they're coexisting for that moment. But
sharing a consciousness, yeah.
But the Ulchis believe that rivers, rocks, streams, birds, animals,
all
grass
can do this.
Listens to us.
Oh.
It all is listening to us. So when we're outside our home, they don't. When you walk outside of your home, it is not your home. The world does not belong to you. It is the place of trees and animals, and you have to be a good guest.
Right.
And that everything is listening to you. It's listening to what you're saying. It's watching your actions.
So remote viewing for these shamans would be, let me go to the place where the rocks or the river are and see what it's seeing.
Yes, and let me look at what's going on from that perspective.
So remote viewing would just be perfectly normal.
Normal, very normal for powerful shamans.
Boy, where do the Ulchi people believe they came from if we're just visitors?
I don't know, but I will tell you something very interesting.
Oh, good.
Liz, you'll like this story. I look at their mask and I look at their art, and the shaman's mask is a very anthropomorphic style. They don't. It's not like the Northwest Coastal Indians where you have the bear and you have the crow. It always has this particular shape to it. And I used to talk to them when Grandfather was here about the outer space, and I would show them pictures of UFOs, and I'd say, "Have you seen those?" And they go, "Of course we've seen those." Well, I would be ask them very stupid questions like, "Well, where do they come from?" They'd look at me like I'm a complete idiot and say, "Well, they're from there." I said, "Well, are there people on
there?"
"Well, of course.
She's pointing up to the
sky. Of course, there are people on there." "Well, where are they?" "They're space people. If you look at their mask," and they said, "Well, look at our mask. They are the exact shape of what we would consider to be people from outer space."
The classic gray alien face?
The classic alien face.
With the big slanty eyes, dark eyes?
Not big eyes, but the entire shape of
kind
the mask.
Kind of triangular?
Itself, yes. Uh-huh. They said, those are the star people. They've always been here. They've always come here. We see them all the time.
Interesting.
Yes. Actually, they were quite offended. We were in a public, PBS, public broadcasting, one of their retail stores, and they had this strange version of the Operation game, but it was called Alien Autopsy. I don't know if you've seen that awful thing.
I'm familiar with the Alien Autopsy hoax,
right,
but they made a game out of it.
This terrible game at it, and Grandfather Misha and Nadezhda were so offended by looking at that. They thought that was the most offensive image they had seen in America. How dare they do that to the star people? So they don't really say where we've come from. Maybe here, maybe there, maybe another planet, but they will tell you that the Earth is not our home. And I think of stewardship sometimes, and I think of this culture and people talking about being good stewards, but sometimes I think about stewardship, and I think it's a very proactive word. Wherein the Ulchis wouldn't necessarily think that we were here to steward things as much as to leave things in balance.
To walk lightly and...
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do they use these masks that you were describing?
The shamans use them primarily. The shamans wore them in all of their ceremonies and their soul retrievals through about the 1920s and the 1930s. And now very few shamans do wear these masks to do their work. And I think it was just due to the fact that during the period of Stalin, when the shamans had to go underground for the period of communism, that they lost or forgot some of the traditions, or they just choose not to wear the mask anymore because it's too big or too heavy or too cumbersome for their work.
Were they carved out of wood?
Carved out of wood.
Uh-huh. The classic Siberian pose, where you're laying down, you've got one arm over here, feet crossed, and a drum on your back. Was that from, or the Ulchi used to use that, or still do?
No.
The soul journeying posture?
No, not
they
at all.
They sat with their journeys a lot, you said.
Well, sometimes they're moving all the time. Sometimes they'll start their journey and they're sitting down and they're quietly calling the spirits to join them. And as soon as their spirits join them, they're off on their journey, on their adventure. And sometimes they'll get up. If a tiger spirit meets them on the road, they'll get up and enact, you know, meeting the tiger spirit on the road, by singing it or physically acting it out or drumming it, and then they'll sit back down and then they'll sing for a while, then they'll get back up. And so they're either dancing, standing, moving, sitting. It varies. It varies depending on the specific shaman and the content of the journey.
And would it last for what, hours, you said? Sometimes all night?
Yes, it'll last all night. The shaman will begin, and he or she will have their client sitting there, and they'll begin to journey for each particular person, and then they'll stop for a while, and then they'll go eat, and then go smoke a cigarette, smoke a pipe full of tobacco, and then they'll start up again, then they'll stop, then they'll take a nap. But when they're taking a nap, they're listening to their spirits. They're taking these kind of little cat naps where they're sort of talking to their spirits at that time. Then they'll get up. Then they'll sing again. Then they'll eat some more. It just goes on all night long till very, very early in the morning.
Is it any wonder to you that the language never was written down, since they're in such a full form of communication with spirits, with otherworldly intelligence? Hard to write some of this down if you're using this language of symbol and experience, and it's hard to contain this when you're using that side of your brain in words.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it hasn't been written, why they're now beginning to record their language or their words with the Russian Cyrillic alphabet, so that there is existing now an Ulchi dictionary in Cyrillic, so that they don't completely lose the language. I'm not sure they had much need to write things down, although they did trade with the ancient Chinese and the ancient Japanese for thousands of years. They did understand, many of the more educated Ulchi people did understand Chinese, and they used that as a trade language.
Interesting. Who else did they communicate with? I mean, these alien forces, the wind, the animals, just everything and anything.
Everything. Everything has a road. Everything has a path. Everything. Everything is alive. A shaman could sit here in this lovely table that you have in the studio right now. The shaman could journey for this table and do a soul retrieval for this table.
Interesting.
Or this microphone. Everything has its life.
And the very air and the ethers and, yeah.
Everything.
Is animate. The statues that are used in symbolic, we asked you in the workshop, how do they understand the statues? And even that could have a consciousness that can be...
It's alive and real. Mm-hmm. It's not just a representation of a deity or a spirit. It is that spirit.
In the sense that the spirit chooses to house itself there, that it can go there to live and express?
Yes. It's
a home base for that spirit?
It's home. It's like inviting people over for dinner, and there is their seat, and there is their name card in front of their seat. They understand, that's where I need to be. They recognize the image. If you look at Ulchi art, you'll look at their design on their clothing, and it's incredibly complex. And yet you look at the statuary of the deities, and they haven't changed since Paleolithic times.
Hmm.
They still have a very crude, primitive look to them. They cannot be changed.
Because?
The spirit won't recognize its seat. It won't recognize its home. And if you make a modern adaptation of a tiger spirit, when the tiger spirit comes, it doesn't recognize that form. It will not live in it.
Interesting. You hear about early indigenous societies who are protecting themselves from ancestors, you know, who are placating the ancestors so they won't harm them. These people invite the communication and invite the cooperation, don't they?
Absolutely. And the Ulchi people, not the ancestors live with us all the time. All of the time. They're always here. You're always making offerings to those people that have passed on. You're always thinking about those people, especially at the new moon. You're always giving offerings of food and alcohol and tobacco to those people that have passed on.
Do they consider themselves lucky that their ancestors were awake and aware and practicing this tradition and look at us and saying, gee, your ancestors didn't know any of this, therefore how can their spirits participate in this?
No, the Ulchi people are an amazing people. The only comment they've ever made about Americans is they feel sorry that Americans have lost their traditions. And they think that is perhaps why American people are so drawn to learn about the Ulchi way of life.
Replacing something that we've lost.
Yes, absolutely. We don't know our grandparents. We don't know where we come from. We have lost our traditions. So they feel like we're a nation of orphans.
Do they look at the future and see what? Have they told you? Just a general prognosis for?
Well, I remember a group of UCLA anthropologists that came up to interview Nyajishtin grandfather 1 year when they were here. And of course, they had this kind of romantic view of indigenous people and their great, you know, word of warning to the way our culture and society was going. They were trying to coax something like that out of the Ulchi people. And grandfather looked at them And he said, oh, no. He says, technology is wonderful. Now, this is a man, granted, 94 years old, had only left his village a couple of times in his lifetime, who came to the United States, who would look at our freeways, especially our clover leaves. He just thought those were the most beautiful things. He'd go, your roads are so beautiful. They believe that technology is normal and is part of our development, and that, like everything else, it's okay to have a power plant next to the river. It just, you have to make sure that they live in balance, that the power plant doesn't pollute the river. So they have no words of warning as we become more technologically involved in life and the world. They believe that this is all part of natural evolution. So I don't think you could coax some horror story about, you know, if we all continue in a particular way or fashion, we're going to blow up the world and everything will end. They don't view things that way.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah, they loved Chinese takeout.
What else did they?
You know, they got spoiled. They went back and had to hunt, and I would call them on these just to call them in the villages would take 2.5 hours just to get through to them, and I would be listening to them. They had been out hunting or working in the forest for 3 or 4 hours gathering things, and I could hear them saying, gee, I wish we had takeout. We liked it when we were at your house. You just got on the phone. We had Chinese food.
Delivered.
So we had Chinese food delivered, my goodness. And now we're back out there, you know, picking mushrooms. And it's taking us 2 hours to row over to that island in our boat. So they got a little spoiled. But,
you could do a whole Crocodile Dundee version movie here.
You probably could, yeah.
That would be very interesting.
They thought technology – they don't have cell phones. Their village has electricity that came in the 1960s. They use dog sleds till the late 1960s. There are very few motorized vehicles in their village. There is electricity, but there is still no running water.
So, Jan, how do they feel about preserving their culture?
That's a very interesting question. I remember when I began this project, it was important for me to not only document their culture, their way of life, their philosophical, religious view of the world through writing and taking notes, through audio, through video recordings. It was so important to me, yet when talking to the elders, I came to understand that if the Ulchis became lost to history, that would be perfectly okay with them. They, not only myself, but as I said, other anthropologists, ethnographers that have come to the area recently that feel a need to preserve these people before they disappear, which they may in a very short amount of time. I don't know if that's a very Eurocentric point of view, but the Ulchi people believe that, well, if they disappear, so what? Many other cultures have come and gone, and it's okay. They have no need to hold on and preserve their culture or to document who they have been or will be.
I guess that's what we would do for ourselves, is to preserve that understanding of the world that can help us, those techniques to open to spirit, to work with spirit, that can help us to work with nature. I guess is something that we need more of. This is a schoolhouse that we need to preserve so we can integrate that, what we can of it, and get back in balance. Well, thank you, Jan, for the conversation and introducing us to the Ulchi people and all the wonderful work that you're doing.
Thank you so very much. I appreciate being here.
Thank you for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
A postscript. We mourn Jan's passing in 2021, as well as the loss of so many of the elders and the shamans of the Ulchi. We hope Jan's work and the Ulchi tradition lives on and on and inspires others to pick up and preserve and carry forth the wisdom of the elders around the globe.